Mr. Fogg found staunch support in Sir Francis Cromarty. Passepartout was also ready for anything. That left the guide. What side would he be on? Cromarty put the question in frank terms.
Sir, the guide answered, I am a Parsi, and this woman is a Parsi. If you intend to save her, I am at your orders.
Good man, said Mr. Fogg. The guide then gave them a few particulars about the victim. She was an Indian of celebrated beauty, the daughter of a rich Bombay merchant. She had received a thoroughly British education in Bombay. Her name was Auda. Left an orphan, she was married against her will to the old Bundelkandi Raja. 3 months later, she had become a widow. Knowing the traditional fate that awaited her, death by burning on her husband's funeral pyre, she escaped, but was immediately recaptured by the Raja's relatives, who had an interest in her death. This tale could only strengthen Mr. Fogg and his companions in their generous resolve. It was decided that the guide should take the elephant towards the Pillagi Pagoda and get as near as possible. Half an hour later, a halt was made in a copse about 500 yards from the pagoda, and out of sight from it, although the fanatic shouting could clearly be heard. The elephant was securely tethered, and the party waited for the night. As soon as the shadows fell, at about 6 o'clock, they decided to reconnoitre the area round the pagoda. The last cries of the fakirs were dying down. As was their custom, these Indians were lost in a haze of liquid opium mixed with an infusion of hashish, and it would perhaps be possible to slip through them and reach the temple. After 10 minutes crawling through the undergrowth, they arrived at a stream, and there, by the light of iron torches covered in burning resin, they saw a huge pile of wood. This was the funeral pyre, precious sandalwood, already impregnated with perfumed oil. On top lay the embalmed body of the Raja. 100 yards away stood the pagoda. Come, whispered the guide. With the utmost caution, he slid silently through the tall grass, followed by his 3 companions. The only sound was the murmuring of the wind in the branches of the trees. The guide stopped at the edge of a clearing. A few resin torches provided light. The ground was strewn with groups of sleepers, overcome by their excesses. It was like a battlefield, strewn with corpses. To the guide's great disappointment, however, the royal guards, with drawn sabres, were still keeping watch at the door of the pagoda, which was lit by torches. Priests were probably keeping watch inside as well. The guide went no further. He realized that it was impossible to force entry into the temple, and so led his companions further back into the shelter of the forest. There they waited until midnight, but the situation did not change. The guards did not relax, and the pagoda remained impregnable. It would be difficult to describe the disappointment of the 4 men. If they couldn't get to the victim, how could they save her?
Is there nothing we can do but leave?
Whispered the Brigadier General.
There is nothing we can do but leave, confirmed the guide.
Wait, said Fogg. There's no hurry. I don't have to be in Allahabad until midday.
But what can you hope for?
Asked Sir Francis. Luck is against us for the moment, said Fogg, but it may change. Meanwhile, Passepartout, perched on one of the lower branches of a tree, was mulling over an idea that had flashed through his mind like lightning, and had then lodged itself immovably in his brain. Supple as a snake, he slithered along his branch, which bowed down almost to the ground. The hours went by, and soon a few lighter streaks in the eastern sky announced the approach of daybreak. This was the moment. It was as though a resurrection had taken place in the sleeping crowd. The unconscious groups came to life. The sounds of the tam-tams rang out. Chants and cries burst forth again. The doors of the pagoda opened, and a bright light flooded out. Mr. Fogg and Sir Francis were able to see the victim. She was being dragged out by 2 priests. It even seemed that, shaking off the stupor of intoxication through instincts of self-preservation, The unfortunate woman was trying to escape from her executioners, but all in vain. The crowd started to move forward. The young woman had collapsed back into the stupor induced by the hashish fumes. She passed between the ranks of the fakirs, who escorted her while maintaining their religious intoning. Under cover of the gloom that still prevailed, Phileas Fogg and his companions joined up with the last ranks of the crowd and followed. 2 minutes later, they arrived at the edge of the stream and stopped less than 50 yards from the funeral pyre on which the Raja's body was lying. In the half-light, they saw the young woman, absolutely motionless, stretched out beside the body of her late husband. Next, a torch was brought forward. The wood, soaked with oil, caught fire straight away. His companions had to hold Phileas Fogg back, for in a moment of selfless madness he was thrusting himself towards the pyre. Fogg had already pushed them aside when the scene abruptly changed. A cry of terror arose. The entire crowd threw themselves to the ground, petrified. Was the old Raja not dead after all? For he was suddenly seen to stand erect. Was he a ghost? Then he took the young woman in his arms and, spectre-like, climbed down from the pyre amidst the swirling smoke. The fakirs, the guards, the priests, in the grip of a sudden terror, lay face down, not daring to contemplate this miracle. In the strong arms of the figure bearing her, the inanimate figure of the victim appeared almost weightless. Mr. Fogg and Sir Francis had remained standing, while the Parsi guide bowed his head. And Passepartout was doubtless just as flabbergasted.
"Let's move," said a familiar voice.
It was Passepartout himself who had crept to the pyre in the middle of the thick smoke. It was Passepartout who had snatched the young woman from the jaws of death. A moment later, the four men and their prize had disappeared into the forest, and soon after the elephant was carrying them away at a rapid trot. But shouts, cries, and then a bullet hole in Mr. Fogg's hat told them that their ruse had been discovered. However, the kidnappers were moving too fast, and a few moments later were out of range of arrows and bullets. An hour later, Passepartout was still chuckling at his triumph. Brigadier General Sir Francis Cromarty had shaken the brave fellow's hand, and his master had said, "Well done," which, from Mr. Fogg, was praise indeed. As for the young Indian woman, she was not conscious of what had happened. Wrapped up in travelling rugs, she was resting in one of the howdahs, as the elephant, guided with great skill by the young Parsi, was moving very quickly through the still dark forest. An hour later, it was crossing an immense plain, and at 7 o'clock a halt was called. Although the Brigadier General had no doubt about the young woman's immediate recovery, he was more worried about her future. He did not hesitate to tell Mr. Fogg that if Mrs. Oudah remained in India, she would inevitably fall into the hands of her executioners. Phileas Fogg replied that he would look into the matter. At about 10, the guide said that they were getting near Allahabad station. The railway line started up again there, with trains going from Allahabad to Calcutta in less than 24 hours. Fogg would, therefore, arrive in time for the boat for Hong Kong, due to leave at noon the following day, the 25th of October. At the station, a room was put at the disposal of Mrs. Oudah, who was now recovering from her ordeal. She proved to be a most beautiful and charming young lady, who spoke excellent English. Passepartout was sent on a shopping expedition and returned with an ensemble of travelling clothes for her, a dress of Scottish material, a huge cloak, and a pelisse of otter fur. While he was away, Mr. Fogg had paid the Parsi his wages and presented him with the elephant. The young man's eyes shone. "Your honour is giving me a fortune," he said. "Take it," said Mr. Fogg, "or I will still be in your debt." Not long afterwards, Fogg, Sir Francis, and Passepartout settled into a comfortable compartment in which Mrs. Oudah occupied the best seat and the train left for Calcutta via Benares. The Brigadier General told Mrs. Oudah exactly what had happened that morning. He emphasized the devotion shown by Phileas Fogg, who had not hesitated to risk his life to save her, as well as the daring of Passepartout during the finale of the adventure. Mrs. Oudah thanked her saviors effusively. Her beautiful eyes expressed this gratitude much more than her lips. Then her thoughts carried her back to the scenes of the suttee. Her eyes refocused on this land of India, where so many dangers still lay in wait for her, and she was overcome with shudders of terror. Phileas Fogg realized what was passing through her mind. He offered to take her to Hong Kong, where she could stay until the affair blew over. Mrs. Oudah accepted the offer with gratitude, as one of her relatives, in fact, lived in Hong Kong. A Parsi, like herself, and one of the most important businessmen of that city. At 12:30, the train stopped at Benares, where Sir Francis said farewell and got off. The troops he was joining were encamped a few miles to the north of the city. The others travelled on, for the rest of the day and all through the night. They finally reached Calcutta at 7 in the morning. The steamship for Hong Kong was not due to weigh anchor until 12. According to Mr. Fogg's programme, he was scheduled to arrive at Calcutta on the 25th of October, and so he had. The 2 days he had gained between London and Bombay had been lost during the crossing of the Indian Peninsula, but we may reasonably assume that Phileas Fogg did not regret them. Passepartout left the compartment first, followed by Mr. Fogg, who helped his young companion out onto the platform. From the shadows of an archway, a pair of sharp eyes watched them closely. It was Inspector Fix. He had arrived in Calcutta the previous day and became most upset when he discovered that he had become separated from his quarry. Consequently, he had mounted watch at the station whenever a train was due in from Allahabad, and his relief was palpable when he could once again feast his eyes on Mr. Fogg. However, that was the only thing he had to be thankful for. A visit to the Calcutta police headquarters had confirmed that the longed-for arrest warrant had still not caught up with him, which meant that he must resign himself to a further extension of his pilgrimage. By now, Mr. Fogg's party had boarded a palki gari, a sort of four-wheeled carriage drawn by a pair of horses. It set off, and Inspector Fix trotted along behind. He was pretty certain that this stage of the journey would not take long. He was right. The palki gari arrived at the docks and stopped at one of the quays. The Rangoon, bound for Hong Kong, lay at anchor half a mile out, her departure flag hoisted at the top of the mast. 11 o'clock was striking. Mr. Fogg was an hour early, as the inspector watched him leave the carriage and get into a boat, together with his companion and his servant. During the first few days of the crossing from Calcutta to Hong Kong, Mrs. Oudah started to get to know Phileas Fogg better. She showed him deep gratitude at all times. For his part, he was unfailingly polite, but with the grace and spontaneity of an automaton. Mrs. Oudah hardly knew what to think, but Passepartout tried to enlighten her on his master's eccentric character. Meanwhile, what was Inspector Fix doing? Convinced that Phileas Fogg was a notorious Bank of England robber, he had given instructions to the Calcutta police that the arrest warrant he had requested from London be sent on to him in Hong Kong. He had then managed to embark on the Rangoon without being spotted by Passepartout, and he hoped to remain concealed until the steamer docked. Hong Kong would be the last British territory encountered on the route round the world. Beyond, China, Japan, and America offered Fogg a virtually secure refuge. A mere warrant wouldn't be enough. An extradition order would be necessary. If the police operation failed in Hong Kong, it would be extremely difficult, if not impossible, to start again with any chance of success. Mrs. Ouder's presence in Phileas Fogg's company also gave him food for thought. Who was this woman? What circumstances had made her Fogg's companion? He wondered if there might be some element of abduction in this affair. If so, he might easily be able to create problems for the kidnapper in Hong Kong. He decided to come out of hiding and question Passepartout. Accordingly, he went up on deck. Passepartout was strolling near the bows when the inspector suddenly rushed up, exclaiming, "It's you! Here! On the Rangoon!"
"Mr. Fix," replied Passepartout, "I left you in Bombay, and I found you again on the way to Hong Kong. Are you travelling around the world as well?" "No, no, no. I'm planning to stop at Hong Kong, at least for a few days. And how is your master, Mr. Fogg?" "In perfect health. And we also have a young lady with us."
"A young lady?"
Passepartout had soon recounted the tale of the sootie and the rescue of Ouder.
"Does your master intend to take this young lady to Europe?"
"No, Mr. Fix. We are simply going to entrust her to one of her relatives, the Honourable Judgy, a rich merchant in Hong Kong."
"Nothing doing there," muttered the detective to himself, hiding his disappointment. "How about a glass of gin, Mr. Passepartout?"
"With pleasure, Mr. Fix."
From that day onwards, Passepartout began to reflect very seriously about the remarkable coincidence that once again Fix was following his master's route. His interpretation was very plausible.
"It's so obvious," he exclaimed. "He's a spy that the gentlemen of the Reform Club have sent to make sure that the journey round the world is properly completed. But it's not right, sending someone to spy on Mr. Fogg, and him so honest and upstanding."
But he resolved to say nothing about it to his master, for fear that he might be offended by the suspicions of those who had bet against him. During the 3rd of November, a storm blew up. The Rangoon had to heave to for half a day. Speed was considerably reduced, and it could be calculated that they would arrive at Hong Kong 20 hours behind schedule, or even more if the storm didn't abate. A loss of 20 hours could put Mr. Fogg's whole journey in danger by making him miss the Yokohama steamship, which connected with the vessel on which he had hoped to travel to San Francisco. Fix welcomed the delay. It meant that Mr. Fogg would have to remain in Hong Kong for some days, awaiting the next boat. During this time, the arrest warrant might well arrive. Fix felt ill, but that didn't matter. Each time his body was doubled up with seasickness, his mind was rejoicing with an immense satisfaction. On the 4th of November, the state of the sea changed. The wind shifted 2 points round to the south, and became favourable once more, and the Rangoon continued on its route at a fine speed. However, not all the lost time could be regained, and land ahoy was heard only at 5 a.m. on the 6th. Phileas Fogg's programme indicated the departure of the Yokohama steamship as the 5th. At 6 o'clock, the pilot climbed on board. Mr. Fogg consulted his Bradshaw, and then asked him if he knew when the next boat for Yokohama was leaving. "Tomorrow, on the morning tide." "And what is the name of this boat?" asked Mr. Fogg.
"The Carnatic."
"Was she not due to sail yesterday?"
"Yes, sir, but I had to repair one of the boilers, so the departure was put off until tomorrow."
On this occasion, luck had wonderfully served Phileas Fogg. It had to be admitted. At 1 o'clock, The Rangoon was at the quayside, and the passengers were going ashore. Since the Carnatic was not due to leave until 5 o'clock the following morning, Mr. Fogg had 16 hours to deal with his business, or rather, Mrs. Ouder's. A suite was reserved for the young woman at a hotel, and he saw to it that she had everything she might need. Then he told her that he was going to seek out the relative to whose care he was planning to entrust her. He drove to the Stock Exchange. There they would certainly know the Honourable Jaji, who was one of the richest businessmen in town. The broker Mr. Fogg introduced himself to did indeed know the Parsi merchant, but revealed that the Honourable Jaji had not been living in Hong Kong for the last 2 years. Having made his fortune, he had settled in Europe. Phileas Fogg returned to the hotel and broke the news to Mrs. Ouder.
"What am I going to do, Mr. Fogg?"
"Come back with us to Europe."
"But I cannot abuse your..."
"You're not abusing, and your presence doesn't slow my program down one bit. Passepartout?"
"Sir?"
"Go to the Carnatic and book 3 cabins. Passepartout headed for the quay the Carnatic was due to sail from. He spotted Fix there. The inspector's face showed signs of terrible disappointment.
"Good," said Passepartout to himself. "Everything is working out badly for the gentlemen of the Reform Club."
He greeted Fix with a joyous smile.
"Well, Mr. Fix, have you decided to come with us to America?"
"Yes,"
replied Fix through gritted teeth.
"Come, come,"
cried Passepartout with peals of laughter.
"I knew you wouldn't be able to bear splitting up from us. Let's go and book your passage."
The two of them went into the shipping office and made the necessary bookings. The clerk informed them that since the repairs to the Carnatic were now finished, the ship was leaving at 8 o'clock that very evening, and not the following morning, as had previously been announced.
"Perfect," said Passepartout. "My master will be delighted. I'll go and tell him."
At this moment, Inspector Fix decided on an extreme course of action. On leaving the office, he offered his companion a drink. As Passepartout had plenty of time, he accepted. There was a tavern on the quayside, so the two of them headed for it. They found a huge, finely decorated room, at the end of which there was a vast sort of camp bed, equipped with cushions, on which several people were sleeping. About 30 customers were sitting at small tables, downing pints of British beer or flagons of spirits. Most were also smoking long pipes of red clay, filled with small pellets of opium mixed with attar of roses. From time to time a smoker would slide under the table. The waiters, taking him by his head and feet, would then carry him to the camp bed and lay him down on it. A number of inebriates were already laid out, side by side, totally incapacitated. 2 bottles of port were ordered, to which the Frenchman did full justice, while Fix, more restrained, observed him with keen interest. They chatted about this and that, and eventually a reference was made to the forthcoming trip on the Carnatic. Remembering that the departure had been brought forward, Passepartout got up and prepared to go and tell his master, since the bottles were empty.
"A moment, please," said Fix. "What is it, Mr. Fix?"
"Have another drink," said Fix, and ordered another bottle. Passepartout felt himself more and more overcome by the alcohol, but Fix was determined to finish him off. On the table were a few pipes of opium. Fix pushed one into Passepartout's hand. The Frenchman lifted it to his lips, lit it, took a few puffs, and then slumped, his head weighed down by the narcotic.
"So," reflected Inspector Fix, "Mr. Fogg will not be told about the Carnatic's departure."
In the morning, Passepartout failed to appear when Mr. Fogg rang. What he thought on learning that his servant hadn't come back to the hotel, nobody could have said. Mr. Fogg merely packed up his bag, sent word to Mrs. Ouder, and ordered a palanquin. It was 8 o'clock. Half an hour later, the travellers were on the quayside and learned that the Carnatic had sailed the night before. At that moment, a person who had been watching Mr. Fogg closely came up. It was Inspector Fix, who now greeted Mr. Fogg as follows.
Are you not in the same situation as myself, sir? Weren't you a passenger on the Rangoon?
Yes, replied Mr. Fogg coldly, but I do not believe that I have had the honour. Fix hastened to introduce himself.
Pray pardon the question, he continued, but were you planning to catch the Carnatic?
We were.
So was I, and I feel very disappointed, said Fix. The Carnatic left Hong Kong 12 hours early without telling anybody, and now we have to wait a whole week for the next ship.
As he spoke, Fix felt his heart leaping with joy. One can therefore imagine the stunning blow he received when he heard Phileas Fogg say, in his usual calm voice, "But it seems to me that there are other ships in Hong Kong harbour." Mr. Fogg offered his arm to Mrs. Owder and headed for the docks. A flabbergasted Fix followed. It was as if he was attached to this man by a cord. For 3 hours, Fogg worked his way round the port without success. Hope began to return to Fix. Then a sailor accosted Fogg in the outer harbour.
Is Sir looking for a boat?
Do you have one ready to sail?
Yes, sir. Pilot boat number 41, the best in the fleet.
Is she fast?
8 to 9 knots, near enough.
Will you take me to Yokohama?
Sir must be joking.
No, I miss the Carnatic and must be in Yokohama by the 14th in time for the San Francisco steamship. I'll pay £100 per day and a reward of £200 if I arrive on time.
Are you in earnest?
Deadly.
Sir, I cannot risk such a long crossing at this time of the year in a boat of scarcely 20 tons, but I could take you to Shanghai.
Yokohama is where I have to catch the boat for America, not Shanghai.
But the steamship for San Francisco doesn't start from Yokohama. It starts from Shanghai.
Are you certain?
Yes.
And when does it leave Shanghai?
At 7 p.m. on the 11th. We got 4 days. We can cover the 800 miles to Shanghai, if we're lucky with the weather.
When could you leave?
In an hour.
Very well. Are you the skipper?
Yes. John Bunsby, of the Tankadere.
Here is £200 on account, Captain. Mr. Fix, he added, if you would care to avail yourself...
Sir,
Fix replied,
I was just going to ask you this favour.
Good, said Fogg. On board in half an hour. By sunrise the following day, the schooner had covered more than 100 miles of the journey from Hong Kong to Shanghai. The captain, John Bunsby, had high hopes, and the whole crew, spurred on by the £200 bonus, were working as hard as they could. In the evening, the skipper used the log line to confirm that they had done 220 miles since Hong Kong. Mr. Fogg could now hope that on arrival at Yokohama, he would not have any delay to write in his programme. At dawn, the wind freshened. The sky gave evidence of a gale building up. At about 8, a raging storm of rain and wind swooped down on the ship. She ran northwards all day, borne on by the monstrous waves. 20 times she was on the point of being overtaken by the mountains of water that rose up at the stern, but a deft twist on the helm by the captain, and catastrophe was prevented. As night fell, the tempest grew worse. Seeing the darkness come down while the storm increased, John Bunsby approached Mr. Fogg.
Sir, we would do well to make for one of the coastal ports.
I think so too.
Ah, but which one?
I only know one, Mr. Fogg answered tranquilly.
Namely?
Shanghai. For a minute the captain could not understand what the reply meant, how much obstinacy and tenacity it involved. Then he exclaimed,
"Yes, sir is quite right. To Shanghai."
It was a terrible night. Only by a miracle did the little schooner avoid capsizing. Day broke again. The storm was still unleashing its force with a dreadful fury. However, the wind fell back to the southeast, which was more favourable. Nevertheless, a great deal of time had been lost. The following night was relatively peaceful, and at daybreak on the 11th, the coast was sighted. John Bunsby confirmed that they were less than 100 miles from Shanghai. 100 miles. But Mr. Fogg had to reach Shanghai that very evening if he was to catch the steamship for Yokohama and America. At midday, the Tankadere was only 45 miles from Shanghai. Great suspense could be felt on board. At 7, they were still 3 miles out. A gruesome oath escaped from the lips of the skipper. The 200-pound bonus was going to slip from his grasp. At this moment, a long black rocket, crowned with a banner of thick smoke, appeared in the distance. It was the General Grant, the steamship sailing for America, leaving at the regulation time.
"Damn and blast!" cried John Bunsby.
"Signal!" shouted Fogg.
A small brass signal cannon was quickly loaded to the muzzle. "Flag at half-mast," ordered Mr. Fogg. This was a distress signal, in the hope that the American steamer would see it and come and meet them. "Fire!" At this point, let us turn the clock back and switch from the boat Mr. Fogg is sailing on to the one he had failed to catch in Hong Kong. The Carnatic had left that city at 6:30 p.m. on the 7th of November and headed at full steam towards Japan. The following morning, the men at the bow were rather surprised to notice a passenger with eyes half-dazed, a shaky walk, and tousled hair. This passenger was Passepartout. The following is what had happened. Shortly after Fix left the opium den, two attendants had lifted Passepartout up as he slept and laid him down on the bed reserved for the opium smokers. 3 hours later, he woke up and left, shouting all the while, as if in a dream, "The Carnatic!" The steamship was ready to sail, with her steam up. Passepartout had only a few steps to take. He threw himself on the gangway, managed to work his way up it, and fell down, insensible, on the foredeck, just as the ship cast off. Sailors, accustomed to this sort of scene, carried the poor fellow down to a second-class cabin, which is where he woke up the following morning, 150 miles off the Chinese coast. Thus Passepartout discovered himself on deck that morning, breathing in mouthfuls of the fresh sea breeze. The pure air sobered him up, and he began to put his thoughts together, not without a certain difficulty.
"I must have been abominably drunk. Whatever will Mr. Fogg say? But at least I didn't miss the boat."
With these words he sought out the purser and asked which cabin Mr. Fogg was in. The purser told him that 3 cabins had been booked in that name, but none of them had been occupied. For a moment, Passepartout's head whirled. Then it all came rushing back to him. The departure time of the Carnatic had been brought forward. He was meant to have told his master, but he hadn't. It was all his fault that Mr. Fogg and Mrs. Oder had missed the boat. The situation was not good. He found himself on his way to Japan alone. He would certainly get there, but how would he get back? His pockets were empty. Not even a shilling, not even a penny. Admittedly, his passage and food had been paid for, so during the whole journey he ate and drank to an indescribable degree. He ate as if Japan was a desert island. On the 13th, the Carnatic entered Yokohama Harbour on the morning tide. The following morning, already famished after a night spent in the open, Passepartout told himself that at all costs he must eat, and the sooner the better. At that moment, His eyes fell on a huge poster that a clown was parading through the streets of Yokohama. It was in English, and read as follows. Troop of Japanese acrobats, under the Honourable William Battlecar, last few performances before departure for the United States. Passepartout followed the poster. 15 minutes later, he stopped in front of a huge shed. He walked through the colonnade at the front and asked for Mr. Battlecar. A gentleman, sporting a thick, grey, goatee beard, approached.
"What do you want?
Do you need a servant?"
"A servant?"
exclaimed Battlecar, stroking his chin.
"Are you strong, by any chance?"
"Especially with a good meal inside me."
"And can you sing?"
"Like a bird."
"Do you know how to sing while standing on your head with a top spinning on the sole of your left foot and a sabre balanced on your right?"
"Why, of course!"
The deal was struck there and then. Let us leave Passepartout in Yokohama and return to the good ship Tankadere. Her signals had been spotted by the General Grant, and the captain had steered towards the gallant little schooner. A few moments later, Phileas Fogg paid his passage on the Tankadere at the price agreed by putting £550 into Skipper John Bunsby's pocket. Then he, Owder and Fix had climbed on board the steamer, which had immediately continued its journey to Yokohama. Arriving on November the 14th, on schedule, Phileas Fogg left Fix to deal with his own affairs and went on board the Carnatic, which was still in harbour. There he learned that Passepartout had arrived at Yokohama the day before. Fogg and Mrs. Owder were due to leave again for San Francisco that same evening on the General Grant, so he set off in search of his servant. He inquired at the French and British consulates, but to no avail. Having explored the streets of Yokohama, he was just about to give up hope of finding Passepartout again when chance, or perhaps a sort of premonition, made him go into the Honourable Battlecar's place of amusement. The show was approaching its climax, which featured a human pyramid, 4 layers high. The 4th layer had just been achieved, and the applause was at its loudest when the pyramid suddenly jerked to and fro. The equilibrium was lost, and the whole structure came crashing down like a house of cards. It was all Passepartout's fault. He was part of the bottom layer, where his undoubted strength would be very useful, and his lack of experience less of a disadvantage, or so it had been thought. But alas, at the critical moment he abandoned his post, leapt over the floodlights, clambered up to the right-hand balcony, and fell at the feet of one of the spectators, shouting,
"Oh, my master! My master!"
"Can it be you?" said Mr. Fogg, not immediately recognizing the Japanese acrobat before him.
"It is,"
came the assurance. "In that case, to the steamship, my good fellow." The General Grant was a huge paddle steamer with a capacity of 2,500 tons, fully equipped and capable of considerable speed. It was rigged as a 3-masted schooner with a large expanse of canvas, which helped the steam tremendously. At a speed of 12 knots, it would take at most 21 days to cross the Pacific. Phileas Fogg, therefore, had good reason to hope that he could reach San Francisco by the 2nd of December, then New York by the 11th, and London by the 20th, thus beating that fateful deadline of the 21st of December by a few hours. So Mr. Fogg was quietly confident. Owder was enjoying his company more and more as she grew to know him better. And Passepartout was mightily relieved to be back where he belonged. Only Inspector Fix remains to be accounted for. On arriving in Yokohama, the policeman immediately headed for the British consulate. There he had finally found the warrant which had been following him since Bombay. One can imagine the detective's disappointment. The warrant was now useless. Mr. Fogg had left British soil. An extradition order was now needed to arrest him.
"So be it,"
Fix had said to himself after the first moment of anger. "My warrant is no longer any use here."
but it will come back into its own in Britain. The scoundrel looks very much as if he actually is returning home, imagining he's thrown the police off the trail. Well, I'll follow him all the way. And from now on, instead of attempting to delay him, I will do all in my power to help him to his destination.
Having made up his mind, he had gone straight on board the General Grant. The following day, he came face to face with Passepartout on the foredeck. If the Frenchman were to punch him on the nose, it would mean that he was aware of the trick Fix had played on him in Hong Kong. But in fact, Passepartout had far too hazy a recollection of what had occurred in the opium den to apportion blame to anyone but himself. Fix revealed that business considerations required him to continue his journey. Passepartout took this as confirmation of his suspicion that Mr. Fix was following instructions from the Reform Club to make sure that Phileas Fogg took no shortcuts in his circuit of the globe. Once cordial relations had been re-established between them, Inspector Fix resumed the friendly relationship with Mr. Fogg and Mrs. Oudah that had been established on the good ship Tankadere. On the 23rd of November, the General Grant crossed the 180th meridian, the one which, in the southern hemisphere, stands at the antipodes of London. Out of the 80 days allotted to him, Mr. Fogg had used up 52, and now only had 28 left. But if he was only halfway round according to the meridians, he had in reality covered more than two-thirds of the distance. 11 days later, on December the 3rd, the General Grant entered Golden Gate Bay and drew up in San Francisco.